Is passion different from reason also, or only a kind of reason? In which latter case, instead of three principles in the soul, there will only be two, the rational and the concupiscent. Or rather, as the state was composed of three classes, traders, auxiliaries, counselors, so may there not be in the individual soul a third element which is passion or spirit, and when not corrupted by bad education, is the natural auxiliary of reason? Yes, he said, there must be a third. Yes, I replied, if passion, which has already been shown to be different from desire, turn out also to be different from reason. But that is easily proved. We may observe even in young children that they are full of spirit almost as soon as they are born, whereas some of them never seem to attain to the use of reason, and most of them late enough. Excellent, I said. And you may see passion equally in brute animals, which is a further proof of the truth of what you are saying. And we may once more appeal to the words of Homer, which have been already quoted by us. He smote his breast and thus rebuked his soul. For in this verse, Homer has clearly supposed the power which reasons about the better and worse to be different from the unreasoning anger which is rebuked by it. Very true, he said. And so, after much tossing, we have reached land, and are fairly agreed that the same principles which exist in the state exist also in the individual, and that they are three in number. Exactly. Must we not then infer that the individual is wise in the same way, and in virtue of the same quality which makes the state wise? Certainly. Also, that the same quality which constitutes courage in the state constitutes courage in the individual, and that both the state and the individual bear the same relation to all the other virtues? Assuredly. And the individual will be acknowledged by us to be just in the same way in which the state is just? That follows, of course. We cannot but remember that the justice of the state consisted in each of the three classes doing the work of its own class. We are not very likely to have forgotten, he said. We must recollect that the individual in whom the several qualities of his nature do their own work will be just and will do his own work? Yes, he said, we must remember that too. And ought not the rational principle, which is wise, and has the care of the whole soul, to rule, and the passionate or spirited principle to be the subject and ally? Certainly. And, as we were saying, the united influence of music and gymnastic will bring them into accord, nerving and sustaining the reason with noble words and lessons, and moderating and soothing and civilizing the wildness of passion by harmony and rhythm? Quite true, he said. And these two, thus nurtured and educated, and having learned truly to know their own functions, will rule over the concupiscent, which in each of us is the largest part of the soul, and by nature most insatiable of gain. Over this they will keep guard, lest, waxing great and strong with the fullness of bodily pleasures, as they are termed, the concupiscent soul, no longer confined to her own sphere, should attempt to enslave and rule those who are not her natural-born subjects, and overturn the whole life of man? Very true, he said. Both together, will they not be the best defenders of the whole soul and the whole body against attacks from without, the one counseling and the other fighting under his leader and courageously executing his commands and counsels? True. And if he is deemed courageous, whose spirit retains in pleasure and in pain the commands of reason about what he ought or ought not to fear? Right, he replied. And him we call wise, who has in him that little part which rules and which proclaims these commands. That part, too, being supposed to have a knowledge of what is for the interest of each of the three parts and of the whole? Assuredly. And would you not say that he is temperate, who has these same elements in friendly harmony, in whom the one ruling principle of reason and the two subject ones of spirit and desire are equally agreed that reason ought to rule and do not rebel? Certainly, he said, that is the true account of temperance, whether in the state or individual. And surely, I said, We have explained again and again how and by virtue of what quality a man will be just. That is very certain. And is justice dimmer in the individual, and is her form different, or is she the same which we found her to be in the state? There is no difference in my opinion, he said, because if any doubt is still lingering in our minds, a few commonplace instances will satisfy us of the truth of what I am saying. What sort of instances do you mean? If the case is put to us, must we not admit that the just state, or the man who is trained in the principles of such a state, will be less likely than the unjust to make away with a deposit of gold or silver? Would anyone deny this? No one, he replied. Will the just man or citizen ever be guilty of sacrilege or theft, or treachery either to his friends or to his country? Never. Neither will he ever break faith where there have been oaths or agreements? Impossible. No one will be less likely to commit adultery, or to dishonor his father and mother, or to fail in his religious duties? No one. And the reason is that each part of him is doing its own business, whether in ruling or being ruled? Exactly so. Are you satisfied, then, that the quality which makes such men and such states is justice? Or do you hope to discover some other? Not I, indeed. Then our dream has been realized. And the suspicion which we entertained at the beginning of our work of construction, that some divine power must have conducted us to a primary form of justice, has now been verified? Yes, certainly. And the division of labor, which required the carpenter and the shoemaker and the rest of the citizens to be doing each his own business and not another's, was a shadow of justice, and for that reason it was of use? Clearly. But in reality, justice was such as we were describing, being concerned, however, not with the outward man, but with the inward, which is the true self and concernment of man. For the just man does not permit the several elements within him to interfere with one another, or any of them to do the work of others. He sets in order his own inner life, and is his own master and his own law, and at peace with himself. And when he has bound together the three principles within him, which may be compared to the higher, lower, and middle notes of the scale, and the intermediate intervals, when he has bound all these together, and is no longer many, but has become one entirely temperate and perfectly adjusted nature, then he proceeds to act, if he has to act, whether in a matter of property, or in the treatment of the body, or in some affair of politics or private business, always thinking and calling that which preserves and cooperates with this harmonious condition just and good action, and the knowledge which presides over it wisdom, and that which at any time impairs this condition he will call unjust action, and the opinion which presides over it ignorance. You have said the exact truth, Socrates. Very good. And if we were to affirm that we had discovered the just man and the just state, and the nature of justice in each of them, we should not be telling a falsehood? Most certainly not. May we say so, then? Let us say so. And now, I said, injustice has to be considered. Clearly. Must not injustice be a strife which arises among the three principles? A meddlesomeness, an interference, and rising up of a part of the soul against the whole, an assertion of unlawful authority, which is made by a rebellious subject against a true prince, of whom he is the natural vassal. What is all this confusion and delusion but injustice, and intemperance and cowardice and ignorance and every form of vice? Exactly so. And if the nature of justice and injustice be known, then the meaning of acting unjustly and being unjust, or again of acting justly, will also be perfectly clear? What do you mean? He said. Why, I said, they are like disease and health, being in the soul just what disease and health are in the body. How so? He said. Why, I said, that which is healthy causes health, and that which is unhealthy causes disease. Yes. And just actions cause justice, and unjust actions cause injustice? That is certain. And the creation of health is the institution of a natural order and government of one by another in the parts of the body. And the creation of disease is the production of a state of things at variance with this natural order? True. And is not the creation of justice the institution of a natural order and government of one by another in the parts of the soul, and the creation of injustice the production of a state of things at variance with the natural order? Exactly so, he said. Then virtue is the health and beauty and well-being of the soul, and vice the disease and weakness and deformity of the same. True. And do not good practices lead to virtue, and evil practices to vice? Assuredly. Still, our old question of the comparative advantage of justice and injustice has not been answered. Which is the more profitable? To be just and act justly and practice virtue, whether seen or unseen of gods and men, or to be unjust and act unjustly, if only unpunished and unreformed? In my judgment, Socrates, the question has now become ridiculous. We know that when the bodily constitution is gone, life is no longer endurable, though pampered with all kinds of meats and drinks, and having all wealth and all power. And shall we be told that when the very essence of the vital principle is undermined and corrupted, life is still worth having to a man, if only he be allowed to do whatever he likes, with the single exception that he is not to acquire justice and virtue, or to escape from injustice and vice, assuming them both to be such as we have described? Yes, I said, the question is, as you say, ridiculous. Still, as we are near the spot at which we may see the truth in the clearest manner with our own eyes, let us not faint by the way. Certainly not, he replied. Come up hither, I said, and behold the various forms of vice, those of them I mean which are worth looking at. I am following you, he replied. Proceed. I said, the argument seems to have reached a height from which, as from some tower of speculation, a man may look down and see that virtue is one, but that the forms of vice are innumerable, there being four special ones which are deserving of note. What do you mean? He said. I mean, I replied, that there appear to be as many forms of the soul as there are distinct forms of the state. How many? There are five of the state and five of the soul, I said. What are they? The first, I said, is that which we have been describing, and which may be said to have two names, monarchy and aristocracy, accordingly as rule is exercised by one distinguished man or by many. True, he replied. But I regard the two names as describing one form only. For whether the government is in the hands of one or many, if the governors have been trained in the manner which we have supposed, the fundamental laws of the state will be maintained. That is true, he replied. Book 5. Such is the good and true city or state. And the good and true man is of the same pattern. And if this is right, every other is wrong. And the evil is one which affects not only the ordering of the state, but also the regulation of the individual soul, and is exhibited in four forms. What are they? He said. I was proceeding to tell the order in which the four evil forms appeared to me to succeed one another, when Polemarchus, who was sitting a little way off, just beyond Adamantus, began to whisper to him. Stretching forth his hand, he took hold of the upper part of his coat by the shoulder, and drew him towards him, leaning forward himself so as to be quite close, and saying something in his ear, of which I only caught the words, "Shall we let him off, or what shall we do?" "Certainly not," said Adamantus, raising his voice. "Who is it?" I said. "Whom you are refusing to let off?" "You," he said. I repeated, "Why am I especially not to be let off?" "Why," he said, We think that you are lazy and mean to cheat us out of a whole chapter which is a very important part of the story, and you fancy that we shall not notice your airy way of proceeding, as if it were self-evident to everybody that in the matter of women and children, friends have all things in common. And was I not right, Adeimantus?
Yes, he said, but what is right in this particular case, like everything else, requires to be explained, for community may be of many kinds. Please, therefore, to say what sort of community you mean. We have long been expecting that you would tell us something about the family life of your citizens, how they will bring children into the world and rear them when they have arrived, and, in general, what is the nature of this community of women and children. For we are of opinion that the right or wrong management of such matters will have a great and paramount influence on the state for good or for evil. And now, since the question is still undetermined, and you are taking in hand another state, we have resolved, as you heard, not to let you go until you give an account of all this.
To that resolution, said Glaucon, you may regard me as saying agreed.
And without more ado, said Thrasymachus, you may consider us all to be equally agreed.
I said, you know not what you are doing in thus assailing me.
What an argument are you raising about the state?
Just as I thought that I had finished and was only too glad that I had laid this question to sleep, and was reflecting how fortunate I was in your acceptance of what I then said, you ask me to begin again at the very foundation, ignorant of what a hornet's nest of words you are stirring. Now I foresaw this gathering trouble and avoided it.
For what purpose did you conceive that we have come here, said Thrasymachus? To look for gold, or to hear discourse?
Yes, but discourse should have a limit.
Yes, Socrates, said Glaucon, and the whole of life is the only limit which wise men assign to the hearing of such discourses. But never mind about us. Take heart yourself, and answer the question in your own way. What sort of community of women and children is this which is to prevail among our guardians? And how shall we manage the period between birth and education, which seems to require the greatest care? Tell us how these things will be.
Yes, my simple friend. But the answer is the reverse of easy. Many more doubts arise about this than about our previous conclusions. For the practicability of what is said may be doubted, and looked at in another point of view, whether the scheme, if ever so practicable, would be for the best, is also doubtful. Hence I feel a reluctance to approach the subject, lest our aspiration, my dear friend, should turn out to be a dream only.
Fear not, he replied, for your audience will not be hard upon you. They are not skeptical or hostile.
I said, my good friend, I suppose that you mean to encourage me by these words.
Yes, he said.
Then let me tell you that you are doing just the reverse. The encouragement which you offer would have been all very well had I myself believed that I knew what I was talking about. To declare the truth about matters of high interest, which a man honors and loves among wise men who love him, need occasion no fear or faltering in his mind. But to carry on an argument when you are yourself only a hesitating inquirer, which is my condition, is a dangerous and slippery thing, and the danger is not that I shall be laughed at, of which the fear would be childish, but that I shall miss the truth where I have most need to be sure of my footing, and drag my friends after me in my fall. And I pray Nemesis not to visit upon me the words which I am going to utter. For I do indeed believe that to be an involuntary homicide is a less crime than to be a deceiver about beauty or goodness or justice in the matter of laws. And that is a risk which I would rather run among enemies than among friends, and therefore you do well to encourage me.
Glaucon laughed and said, well then, Socrates, in case you and your argument do us any serious injury, you shall be acquitted beforehand of the homicide, and shall not be held up to be a deceiver. Take courage, then, and speak.
Well, I said, the law says that when a man is acquitted, he is free from guilt.
and what holds that law may hold an argument.
Then why should you mind?
Well, I replied, I suppose that I must retrace my steps and say what I perhaps ought to have said before in the proper place. The part of the men has been played out, and now, properly enough, comes the turn of the women. Of them I will proceed to speak, and the more readily since I am invited by you. For men born and educated like our citizens, the only way, in my opinion, of arriving at a right conclusion about the possession and use of women and children is to follow the path on which we originally started, when we said that the men were to be the guardians and watchdogs of the herd.
True.
Let us further suppose the birth and education of our women to be subject to similar or nearly similar regulations. Then we shall see whether the result accords with our design.
What do you mean?
What I mean may be put in the form of a question, I said. Are dogs divided into he's and she's, or do they both share equally in hunting and in keeping watch and in the other duties of dogs? Or do we entrust to the males the entire and exclusive care of the flocks, while we leave the females at home, under the idea that the bearing and suckling their puppies is labor enough for them?
No, he said, they share alike. The only difference between them is that the males are stronger and the females weaker.
But can you use different animals for the same purpose, unless they are bred and fed in the same way?
You cannot.
Then if women are to have the same duties as men, they must have the same nurture and education.
Yes.
The education which was assigned to the men was music and gymnastic.
Yes.
Then women must be taught music and gymnastic, and also the art of war which they must practice, like the men?
That is the inference, I suppose.
I should rather expect, I said, that several of our proposals, if they are carried out, being unusual, may appear ridiculous.
No doubt of it.
Yes, and the most ridiculous thing of all will be the sight of women naked in the palestra, exercising with the men, especially when they are no longer young. They certainly will not be a vision of beauty, any more than the enthusiastic old men who, in spite of wrinkles and ugliness, continue to frequent the gymnasia.
Yes, indeed, he said.
According to present notions, the proposal would be thought ridiculous.
But then, I said, as we have determined to speak our minds, we must not fear the jests of the wits that will be directed against this sort of innovation. How they will talk of women's attainments both in music and gymnastic, and above all about their wearing armor and riding upon horseback.
Very true, he replied.
Yet having begun, we must go forward to the rough places of the law, at the same time begging of these gentlemen for once in their life to be serious. Not long ago, as we shall remind them, the Hellenes were of the opinion, which is still generally received among the barbarians, that the sight of a naked man was ridiculous and improper. And when first the Cretans and then the Lacedaemonians introduced the custom, the wits of that day might equally have ridiculed the innovation.
No doubt.
But when experience showed that to let all things be uncovered was far better than to cover them up, and the ludicrous effect to the outward eye vanished before the better principle which reason asserted, then the man was perceived to be a fool who directs the shafts of his ridicule at any other sight but that of folly and vice, or seriously inclines to weigh the beautiful by any other standard but that of the good.
Very true, he replied.
First, then, whether the question is to be put in jest or in earnest, let us come to an understanding about the nature of woman. Is she capable of sharing either wholly or partially in the actions of men, or not at all? And is the art of war one of those arts in which she can or cannot share? That will be the best way of commencing the inquiry, and will probably lead to the fairest conclusion.
That will be much the best way.
Shall we take the other side first, and begin by arguing against ourselves? In this manner the adversary's position will not be undefended.
Why not? He said.
Then let us put a speech into the mouths of our opponents. They will say,
Socrates and Glaucon, no adversary need convict you, for you yourselves, at the first foundation of the state, admitted the principle that everybody was to do the one work suited to his own nature. And certainly, if I am not mistaken, such an admission was made by us. And do not the natures of men and women differ very much indeed? And we shall reply, of course they do. Then we shall be asked, whether the tasks assigned to men and to women should not be different, and such as are agreeable to their different natures. Certainly they should. But if so, have you not fallen into a serious inconsistency in saying that men and women, whose natures are so entirely different, ought to perform the same actions? What defense will you make for us, my good sir, against anyone who offers these objections? That is not an easy question to answer when asked suddenly, and I shall, and I do beg of you, to draw out the case on our side. These are the objections, Glaucon, and there are many others of a like kind, which I foresaw long ago. They made me afraid and reluctant to take in hand any law about the possession and nurture of women and children. By Zeus, he said, the problem to be solved is anything but easy. Why, yes, I said. But the fact is that when a man is out of his depth, whether he has fallen into a little swimming bath or into mid-ocean, he has to swim all the same. Very true. And must not we swim and try to reach the shore? We will hope that Orion's dolphin or some other miraculous help may save us. I suppose so, he said. Well then, let us see if any way of escape can be found. We acknowledged, did we not, that different natures ought to have different pursuits, and that men's and women's natures are different. And now what are we saying? That different natures ought to have the same pursuits. This is the inconsistency which is charged upon us. Precisely. Verily, Glaucon, I said, glorious is the power of the art of contradiction. Why do you say so? Because I think that many a man falls into the practice against his will. When he thinks that he is reasoning, he is really disputing, just because he cannot define and divide, and so know that of which he is speaking, and he will pursue a merely verbal opposition in the spirit of contention, and not of fair discussion. Yes, he replied, such is very often the case. But what has that to do with us and our argument? A great deal. For there is certainly a danger of our getting unintentionally into a verbal opposition. In what way? Why we valiantly and pugnaciously insist upon the verbal truth, that different natures ought to have different pursuits, but we never considered at all what was the meaning of sameness or difference of nature, or why we distinguished them when we assigned different pursuits to different natures and the same to the same natures. Why, no, he said, that was never considered by us. I said, suppose that by way of illustration, we were to ask the question whether there is not an opposition in nature between bald men and hairy men. And if this was admitted by us, then if bald men are cobblers, we should forbid the hairy men to be cobblers, and conversely. That would be a jest, he said. Yes, I said, a jest. And why? Because we never meant, when we constructed the state, that the opposition of natures should extend to every difference, but only to those differences which affected the pursuit in which the individual is engaged. We should have argued, for example, that a physician, and one who is in mind a physician, may be said to have the same nature. True. Whereas the physician and the carpenter have different natures? Certainly. And if, I said, the male and female sex appear to differ in their fitness for any art or pursuit, we should say that such pursuit or art ought to be assigned to one or the other of them. But if the difference consists only in women bearing and men begetting children, this does not amount to a proof that a woman differs from a man in respect of the sort of education she should receive, and we shall therefore continue to maintain that our guardians and their wives ought to have the same pursuits. Very true, he said. Next, we shall ask our opponent how, in reference to any of the pursuits or arts of civic life, the nature of a woman differs from that of a man. That will be quite fair. And perhaps he, like yourself, will reply that to give a sufficient answer on the instant is not easy. But after a little reflection, there is no difficulty.
Yes, perhaps.
Suppose, then, that we invite him to accompany us in the argument, and then we may hope to show him that there is nothing peculiar in the constitution of women that would affect them in the administration of the state.
By all means.
Let us say to him, come now, and we will ask you a question. When you spoke of a nature gifted or not gifted in any respect, did you mean to say that one man will acquire a thing easily, another with difficulty? A little learning will lead the one to discover a great deal, whereas the other, after much study and application, no sooner learns than he forgets. Or again, did you mean that the one has a body which is a good servant to his mind, while the body of the other is a hindrance to him? Would not these be the sort of differences which distinguish the man gifted by nature from the one who is ungifted?
No one will deny that.
And can you mention any pursuit of mankind in which the male sex has not all these gifts and qualities in a higher degree than the female? Need I waste time in speaking of the art of weaving and the management of pancakes and preserves, in which womankind does really appear to be great, and in which for her to be beaten by a man is, of all things, the most absurd?
You are quite right, he replied, in maintaining the general inferiority of the female sex. Although many women are in many things superior to many men, yet, on the whole, what you say is true.
And if so, my friend, I said, there is no special faculty of administration in a state which a woman has because she is a woman, or which a man has by virtue of his sex. But the gifts of nature are alike diffused in both. All the pursuits of men are the pursuits of women also. But in all of them a woman is inferior to a man.
Very true.
Then are we to impose all our enactments on men, and none of them on women?
That will never do.
One woman has a gift of healing, another not. One is a musician, and another has no music in her nature.
Very true.
And one woman has a turn for gymnastic and military exercises, and another is unwarlike and hates gymnastics.
Certainly.
And one woman is a philosopher, and another is an enemy of philosophy. One has spirit, and another is without spirit.
That is also true.
Then one woman will have the temper of a guardian, and another not. Was not the selection of the male guardians determined by differences of this sort?
Yes.
Men and women alike possess the qualities which make a guardian. They differ only in their comparative strength or weakness.
Obviously.
And those women who have such qualities are to be selected as the companions and colleagues of men who have similar qualities and whom they resemble in capacity and in character.
Very true.
And ought not the same natures to have the same pursuits?
They ought.
Then, as we were saying before, there is nothing unnatural in assigning music and gymnastic to the wives of the guardians. To that point we come round again.
Certainly not.
The law which we then enacted was agreeable to nature, and therefore not an impossibility or mere aspiration. And the contrary practice which prevails at present is, in reality, a violation of nature.
That appears to be true.
We had to consider first whether our proposals were possible, and secondly, whether they were the most beneficial?
Yes.
And the possibility has been acknowledged?
Yes.
The very great benefit has next to be established?
Quite so.
You will admit that the same education which makes a man a good guardian will make a woman a good guardian, for their original nature is the same?
Yes.
I should like to ask you a question.
What is it?
Would you say that all men are equal in excellence, or is one man better than another?
The latter.
And in the commonwealth which we were founding, do you conceive the guardians who have been brought up on our model system to be more perfect men, or the cobblers whose education has been cobbling? What a ridiculous question. You have answered me, I replied. Well, and may we not further say that our guardians are the best of our citizens? By far the best. And will not their wives be the best women? Yes, by far the best. And can there be anything better for the interests of the state than that the men and women of a state should be as good as possible? There can be nothing better. And this is what the arts of music and gymnastic, when present in such manner as we have described, will accomplish? Certainly. Then we have made an enactment not only possible, but in the highest degree beneficial to the state? True. Then let the wives of our guardians strip, for their virtue will be their robe, and let them share in the toils of war and the defense of their country. Only in the distribution of labors the lighter are to be assigned to the women, who are the weaker natures, but in other respects their duties are to be the same. And as for the man who laughs at naked women exercising their bodies from the best of motives, in his laughter he is plucking a fruit of unripe wisdom. And he himself is ignorant of what he is laughing at or what he is about. For that is and ever will be the best of sayings, that the useful is the noble and the hurtful is the base. Very true. Here, then, is one difficulty in our law about women, which we may say that we have now escaped. The wave has not swallowed us up alive for enacting that the guardians of either sex should have all their pursuits in common. To the utility and also to the possibility of this arrangement, the consistency of the argument with itself bears witness. Yes, that was a mighty wave which you have escaped. Yes, I said, but a greater is coming. You will not think much of this when you see the next. Go on. Let me see. The law, I said, which is the sequel of this and of all that has preceded, is to the following effect. That the wives of our guardians are to be common, and their children are to be common, and no parent is to know his own child, nor any child his parent. Yes, he said, that is a much greater wave than the other, and the possibility as well as the utility of such a law are far more questionable. I do not think, I said, that there can be any dispute about the very great utility of having wives and children in common. The possibility is quite another matter, and will be very much disputed. I think that a good many doubts may be raised about both. You imply that the two questions must be combined, I replied. Now I meant that you should admit the utility, and in this way, as I thought, I should escape from one of them, and then there would remain only the possibility. But that little attempt is detected, and therefore you will please to give a defense of both. Well, I said, I submit to my fate. Yet grant me a little favor. Let me feast my mind with the dream, as daydreamers are in the habit of feasting themselves when they are walking alone. For before they have discovered any means of effecting their wishes, that is a matter which never troubles them. They would rather not tire themselves by thinking about possibilities. But assuming that what they desire is already granted to them, they proceed with their plan, and delight in detailing what they mean to do when their wish has come true. That is a way which they have of not doing much good to a capacity which was never good for much. Now I myself am beginning to lose heart, and I should like, with your permission, to pass over the question of possibility at present. Assuming, therefore, the possibility of the proposal, I shall now proceed to inquire how the rulers will carry out these arrangements, and I shall demonstrate that our plan, if executed, will be of the greatest benefit to the state and to the guardians. First of all, then, if you have no objection, I will endeavor with your help to consider the advantages of the measure, and hereafter the question of possibility. I have no objection. Proceed. First, I think that if our rulers and their auxiliaries are to be worthy of the name which they bear, there must be willingness to obey in the one and the power of command in the other. The guardians must themselves obey the laws, and they must also imitate the spirit of them in any details which are entrusted to their care.
That is right, he said.
You, I said, who are their legislator, having selected the men, will now select the women and give them to them. They must be as far as possible of like natures with them, and they must live in common houses and meet at common meals. None of them will have anything specially his or her own. They will be together and will be brought up together and will associate at gymnastic exercises. And so they will be drawn by a necessity of their natures to have intercourse with each other. Necessity is not too strong a word, I think.
Yes, he said. Necessity, not geometrical, but another sort of necessity which lovers know, and which is far more convincing and constraining to the mass of mankind.
True, I said. And this, Glaucon, like all the rest, must proceed after an orderly fashion. In a city of the blessed, licentiousness is an unholy thing which the rulers will forbid.
Yes, he said, and it ought not to be permitted.
Then clearly the next thing will be to make matrimony sacred in the highest degree. And what is most beneficial will be deemed sacred?
Exactly.
And how can marriages be made most beneficial? That is a question which I put to you, because I see in your house dogs for hunting, and of the nobler sort of birds not a few. Now, I beseech you, do tell me, have you ever attended to their pairing and breeding?
In what particulars?
Why, in the first place, although they are all of a good sort, are not some better than others?
True.
And do you breed from them all indifferently? Or do you take care to breed from the best only?
From the best.
And do you take the oldest or the youngest, or only those of ripe age?
I choose only those of ripe age.
And if care was not taken in the breeding, your dogs and birds would greatly deteriorate?
Certainly.
And the same of horses and animals in general?
Undoubtedly.
Good heavens, my dear friend, I said. What consummate skill will our rulers need if the same principle holds of the human species?
Certainly, the same principle holds, but why does this involve any particular skill?
Because, I said, our rulers will often have to practice upon the body corporate with medicines. Now, you know that when patients do not require medicines, but have only to be put under a regimen, the inferior sort of practitioner is deemed to be good enough. But when medicine has to be given, then the doctor should be more of a man.
That is quite true, he said.
But to what are you alluding?
I mean, I replied, that our rulers will find a considerable dose of falsehood and deceit necessary for the good of their subjects.
We were saying that the use of all these things regarded as medicines might be of advantage.
And we were very right.
And this lawful use of them seems likely to be often needed in the regulations of marriages and births.
How so?
Why, I said, the principle has been already laid down that the best of either sex should be united with the best as often and the inferior with the inferior as seldom as possible, and that they should rear the offspring of the one sort of union but not of the other, if the flock is to be maintained in first-rate condition. Now these goings-on must be a secret which the rulers only know, or there will be a further danger of our herd, as the guardians may be termed, breaking out into rebellion.
Very true.
Had we not better appoint certain festivals at which we will bring together the brides and bridegrooms, and sacrifices will be offered and suitable hymeneal songs composed by our poets? The number of weddings is a matter which must be left to the discretion of the rulers, whose aim will be to preserve the average of population. There are many other things which they will have to consider, such as the effects of wars and diseases and any similar agencies, in order as far as this is possible to prevent the state from becoming either too large or too small.
Certainly, he replied.
We shall have to invent some ingenious kind of lots, which the less worthy may draw on each occasion of our bringing them together, and then they will accuse their own ill luck and not the rulers.
To be sure, he said.
And I think that our braver and better youth, besides their other honors and rewards, might have greater facilities of intercourse with women given them. Their bravery will be a reason, and such fathers ought to have as many sons as possible.
True.
And the proper officers, whether male or female or both, for offices are to be held by women as well as by men.
Yes.
The proper officers will take the offspring of the good parents to the pen or fold, and there they will deposit them with certain nurses who dwell in a separate quarter. But the offspring of the inferior, or of the better when they chance to be deformed, will be put away in some mysterious, unknown place, as they should be.
Yes, he said, that must be done if the breed of the guardians is to be kept pure.
They will provide for their nurture, and will bring the mothers to the fold when they are full of milk, taking the greatest possible care that no mother recognizes her own child, and other wet nurses may be engaged if more are required. Care will also be taken that the process of suckling shall not be protracted too long, and the mothers will have no getting up at night or other trouble, but will hand over all this sort of thing to the nurses and attendants.
You suppose the wives of our guardians to have a fine, easy time of it when they are having children?
Why, said I, and so they ought. Let us, however, proceed with our scheme. We were saying that the parents should be in the prime of life.
Very true.
And what is the prime of life? May it not be defined as a period of about 20 years in a woman's life and 30 in a man's?
Which years do you mean to include?
A woman, I said, at 20 years of age may begin to bear children to the state, and continue to bear them until 40. A man may begin at 25 when he has passed the point at which the pulse of life beats quickest, and continue to beget children until he be 55.
Certainly, he said, both in men and women those years are the prime of physical as well as of intellectual vigor.
Anyone above or below the prescribed ages who takes part in the public hymeneals shall be said to have done an unholy and unrighteous thing. The child of which he is the father, if it steals into life, will have been conceived under auspices very unlike the sacrifices and prayers which at each hymeneal priestesses and priests and the whole city will offer, that the new generation may be better and more useful than their good and useful parents, whereas his child will be the offspring of darkness and strange lust.
Very true, he replied.
And the same law will apply to any one of those within the prescribed age who forms a connection with any woman in the prime of life without the sanction of the rulers, for we shall say that he is raising up a bastard to the state, uncertified and unconsecrated.
Very true, he replied.
This applies, however, only to those who are within the specified age. After that we allow them to range at will, except that a man may not marry his daughter or his daughter's daughter, or his mother or his mother's mother. And women, on the other hand, are prohibited from marrying their sons or fathers, or son's son or father's father, and so on in either direction. And we grant all this, accompanying the permission with strict orders to prevent any embryo which may come into being from seeing the light. And if any force away to the birth, the parents must understand that the offspring of such a union cannot be maintained, and arrange accordingly.
That also, he said, is a reasonable proposition.
But how will they know who are fathers and daughters and so on?
They will never know.
The way will be this. Dating from the day of the hymeneal, the bridegroom who is then married will call all the male children who are born in the 7th and 10th month afterwards his sons, and the female children his daughters, and they will call him father, and he will call their children his grandchildren, and they will call the elder generation grandfathers and grandmothers. All who were begotten at the time when the fathers and their mothers came together will be called their brothers and sisters. And these, as I was saying, will be forbidden to intermarry. This, however, is not to be understood as an absolute prohibition of the marriage of brothers and sisters. If the lot favors them, and they receive the sanction of the Pythian oracle, the law will allow them.
Quite right, he replied.
Such is the scheme, Glaucon, according to which the guardians of our state are to have their wives and families in common. And now you would have the argument show that this community is consistent with the rest of our polity, and also that nothing can be better. Would you not? Yes, certainly. Shall we try to find a common basis by asking of ourselves, what ought to be the chief aim of the legislator in making laws and in the organization of the state? What is the greatest good, and what is the greatest evil? And then consider whether our previous description has the stamp of the good or of the evil. By all means. Can there be any greater evil than discord and distraction and plurality where unity ought to reign? Or any greater good than the bond of unity? There cannot. And there is unity where there is community of pleasures and pains, where all the citizens are glad or grieved on the same occasions of joy and sorrow? No doubt. Yes. And where there is no common, but only private feeling, a state is disorganized. When you have one half of the world triumphing and the other plunged in grief at the same events happening to the city or the citizens? Certainly. Such differences commonly originate in a disagreement about the use of the terms mine and not mine, his and not his. Exactly so. And is not that the best ordered state in which the greatest number of persons apply the terms mine and not mine in the same way to the same thing? Quite true. Or that again which most nearly approaches to the condition of the individual, as in the body, when but a finger of one of us is hurt, the whole frame, drawn towards the soul as a center, and forming one kingdom under the ruling power therein, feels the hurt and sympathizes altogether with the part affected, and we say that the man has a pain in his finger. And the same expression is used about any other part of the body, which has a sensation of pain at suffering or of pleasure at the alleviation of suffering. Very true, he replied, and I agree with you that in the best ordered state, there is the nearest approach to this common feeling which you describe. Then when any one of the citizens experiences any good or evil, the whole state will make his case their own, and will either rejoice or sorrow with him? Yes, he said. That is what will happen in a well-ordered state. It will now be time, I said, for us to return to our state, and see whether this or some other form is most in accordance with these fundamental principles. Very good. Our state, like every other, has rulers and subjects, true. All of whom will call one another citizens, of course. But is there not another name which people give to their rulers in other states? Generally they call them masters, but in democratic states they simply call them rulers. And in our state, what other name besides that of citizens do the people give their rulers? They are called saviors and helpers, he replied. And what do the rulers call the people? Their maintainers and foster fathers. And what do they call them in other states? Slaves. And what do the rulers call one another in other states? Fellow rulers. And what in ours? Fellow guardians. Did you ever know an example in any other state of a ruler who would speak of one of his colleagues as his friend and of another as not being his friend? Yes, very often. And the friend he regards and describes as one in whom he has an interest and the other as a stranger in whom he has no interest? Exactly. But would any of your guardians think or speak of any other guardian as a stranger? Certainly he would not, for everyone whom they meet will be regarded by them either as a brother or sister or father or mother or son or daughter, or as the child or parent of those who are thus connected with him. Capital, I said. But let me ask you once more, shall they be a family in name only, or shall they in all their actions be true to the name? For example, in the use of the word father, would the care of a father be implied, and the filial reverence and duty and obedience to him which the law commands? And is the violator of these duties to be regarded as an impious and unrighteous person who is not likely to receive much good either at the hands of God or of man? Are these to be or not to be the strains which the children will hear repeated in their ears by all the citizens about those who are intimated to them to be their parents and the rest of their kinsfolk?
"These," he said, "and none other. For what can be more ridiculous than for them to utter the names of family ties with the lips only, and not to act in the spirit of them?"
Then in our city, the language of harmony and concord will be more often heard than in any other. As I was describing before, when anyone is well or ill, the universal word will be, "With me it is well," or "It is ill."
Most true.
And agreeably to this mode of thinking and speaking, were we not saying that they will have their pleasures and pains in common?
Yes, and so they will.
And they will have a common interest in the same thing which they will alike call my own. And having this common interest, they will have a common feeling of pleasure and pain?
Yes, far more so than in other states.
And the reason of this, over and above the general constitution of the state, will be that the guardians will have a community of women and children?
That will be the chief reason.
And this unity of feeling we admitted to be the greatest good, as was implied in our own comparison of a well-ordered state to the relation of the body and the members, when affected by pleasure or pain,
that we acknowledged, and very rightly.
Then the community of wives and children among our citizens is clearly the source of the greatest good to the state.
Certainly.
And this agrees with the other principle which we were affirming, that the guardians were not to have houses or lands or any other property. Their pay was to be their food, which they were to receive from the other citizens, and they were to have no private expenses, for we intended them to preserve their true character of guardians.
Right, he replied.
Both the community of property and the community of families, as I am saying, tend to make them more truly guardians. They will not tear the city in pieces by differing about mine and not mine. Each man dragging any acquisition which he has made into a separate house of his own, where he has a separate wife and children and private pleasures and pains. But all will be affected, as far as may be, by the same pleasures and pains, because they are all of one opinion about what is near and dear to them, and therefore they all tend towards a common end.
Certainly, he replied.
And as they have nothing but their persons which they can call their own, suits and complaints will have no existence among them. They will be delivered from all those quarrels of which money or children or relations are the occasion.
Of course they will.
Neither will trials for assault or insult ever be likely to occur among them. For that equals should defend themselves against equals, we shall maintain to be honorable and right. We shall make the protection of the person a matter of necessity.
That is good, he said.
Yes, and there is a further good in the law, viz., that if a man has a quarrel with another, he will satisfy his resentment then and there, and not proceed to more dangerous lengths.
Certainly.
To the elder shall be assigned the duty of ruling and chastising the younger.
Clearly.
Nor can there be a doubt that the younger will not strike or do any other violence to an elder unless the magistrates command him, nor will he slight him in any way. For there are two guardians, shame and fear, mighty to prevent him. Shame, which makes men refrain from laying hands on those who are to them in the relation of parents. Fear, that the injured one will be succored by the others who are his brothers, sons, fathers.
That is true, he replied.
Then, in every way, the laws will help the citizens to keep the peace with one another.
Yes, there will be no want of peace.
And as the guardians will never quarrel among themselves, there will be no danger of the rest of the city being divided either against them or against one another.
None whatever.
I hardly like even to mention the little meannesses of which they will be rid, for they are beneath notice. Such, for example, as the flattery of the rich by the poor, and all the pains and pangs which men experience in bringing up a family, and in finding money to buy necessaries for their household, borrowing and then repudiating, getting how they can, and giving the money into the hands of women and slaves to keep, the many evils of so many kinds which people suffer in this way are mean enough and obvious enough, and not worth speaking of.
Yes, he said.
A man has no need of eyes in order to perceive that. And from all these evils they will be delivered, and their life will be blessed as the life of Olympic victors, and yet more blessed.
How so?
The Olympic victor, I said, is deemed happy in receiving a part only of the blessedness which is secured to our citizens, who have won a more glorious victory and have a more complete maintenance at the public cost. For the victory which they have won is the salvation of the whole state, and the crown with which they and their children are crowned is the fullness of all that life needs. They receive rewards from the hands of their country while living, and after death have an honorable burial.
Yes, he said, and glorious rewards they are.
Do you remember, I said, how in the course of the previous discussion, someone who shall be nameless accused us of making our guardians unhappy? They had nothing and might have possessed all things. To whom we replied that, if an occasion offered, we might perhaps hereafter consider this question, but that, as at present advised, we would make our guardians truly guardians, and that we were fashioning the state with a view to the greatest happiness, not of any particular class, but of the whole?
Yes, I remember.
And what do you say, now that the life of our protectors is made out to be far better and nobler than that of Olympic victors? Is the life of shoemakers, or any other artisans, or of husbandmen, to be compared with it?
Certainly not.
At the same time, I ought here to repeat what I have said elsewhere, that if any of our guardians shall try to be happy in such a manner that he will cease to be a guardian, and is not content with this safe and harmonious life, which, in our judgment, is of all lives the best, but infatuated by some youthful conceit of happiness which gets up into his head, shall seek to appropriate the whole state to himself, then he will have to learn how wisely Hesiod spoke when he said, "Half is more than the whole." If he were to consult me, I should say to him, "Stay where you are, when you have the offer of such a life."
"You agree, then," I said, "that men and women are to have a common way of life such as we have described, common education, common children, and they are to watch over the citizens in common, whether abiding in the city or going out to war. They are to keep watch together, and to hunt together like dogs, and always and in all things, as far as they are able, women are to share with the men. And in so doing they will do what is best, and will not violate, but preserve the natural relation of the sexes."
"I agree with you," he replied.
"The inquiry," I said, "has yet to be made whether such a community be found possible, as among other animals, so also among men, and if possible, in what way possible?"
"You have anticipated the question which I was about to suggest."
"There is no difficulty," I said, "in seeing how war will be carried on by them."
"How?"
"Why, of course, they will go on expeditions together, and will take with them any of their children who are strong enough, that, after the manner of the artisan's child, they may look on at the work which they will have to do when they are grown up. And besides looking on, they will have to help and be of use in war, and to wait upon their fathers and mothers. Did you never observe in the arts how the potter's boys look on and help long before they touch the wheel?"
"Yes, I have."
"And shall potters be more careful in educating their children and in giving them the opportunity of seeing and practicing their duties than our guardians will be?"
"The idea is ridiculous," he said.
"There is also the effect of the parents, with whom, as with other animals, the presence of their young ones will be the greatest incentive to valor."
"That is quite true, Socrates. And yet, if they are defeated, which may often happen in war, how great the danger is! The children will be lost as well as their parents, and the state will never recover."
"True," I said. "But would you never allow them to run any risk?"
"I am far from saying that."
"Well, but if they are ever to run a risk, should they not do so on some occasion when, if they escape disaster, they will be the better for it?"
"Clearly."
"Whether the future soldiers do or do not see war in the days of their youth is a very important matter, for the sake of which some risk may fairly be incurred."
"Yes, very important." This, then, must be our first step.